Well, we're back for American 2, and we want to talk a little bit about the Cold War and the emerging Cold War and the presidency of Harry Truman and the accomplishments during the presidency of Harry Truman. Already before World War II had ended, there was some disagreement. There was some mistrust between a guy like President Franklin Roosevelt and Joseph Stalin. And at Yalta in February of 1945, the Yalta Conference, and then again at Potsdam in the summer of 1945, there is some key mistrust between the United States and the Soviet Union. At Yalta, it was decided, of course, that Germany would be divided into zones, that Berlin would be divided into zones between the Allies and Soviet Russia, which had been allowed to capture Berlin, and also as an agreement at Yalta, there was to be unconditional surrender of the Axis powers. At Yalta, there was also some agreement about free elections in Poland. So already, like we said, with Roosevelt and Churchill at the Atlantic Charter Conference, you know, people are thinking about the post-war world. This is a time when a country like Yugoslavia is divided among free peoples and possible communists. And, you know, there's a big question in places like Vietnam, even, during the Second World War, about what Vietnam is going to look like at the end of the war. And Franklin Roosevelt had promised, had intimated through channels that there would be a free Vietnam. Of course, Vietnam was a French colony before World War II, and they certainly wanted that colony back. So these are going to be some issues that we'll see during the Cold War. Well, World War II ends, and a place like, well, anyhow, let's go back. World War II ends, President Truman is in office, the atomic bomb has been dropped, and you've ushered in a new atomic age. And also the big question is going to be, what are some of those countries in Eastern Europe going to be looking like at the end of the war? For example, there's supposed to be free elections in Poland. Those free elections will never be held because Soviet Russia will capture places like Czechoslovakia and Poland, and when they do run candidates for elected office, all of them are communist. So the people in those places are not getting, they may be getting a choice per se, but they're not getting a change in the relationship between the people towards their government. In 1946, the former British Prime Minister, who had been voted out of office by the summer of 1945, Winston Churchill, is invited to a small college, Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, to be part of something called the Green Lectures, which was a series of lectures that the college provided. Churchill comes to Fulton, Missouri. He offers his speech called The Sinews of Peace. What a lot of people simply call it today is the Iron Curtain speech. And what Churchill laid out for the people in attendance and for the rest of us is that an Iron Curtain was descending across the continent of Europe. And what he meant by that, by 1946, was that the world was being divided slowly into perhaps a democratic camp and a communist camp. Because what had Soviet Russia done? They had basically taken over parts of Eastern Europe and developed those countries into satellite nations. In other words, they were turning those countries communist. They were also milking and mining the great resources of these countries to benefit themselves. And so one of the things that Churchill was talking about was the Iron Curtain was descending across the continent. Shortly after, the United States, led by a researcher by the name of George Kennan, will issue a series of papers on communism. And basically a theory will be outlined that the United States needed to do whatever it could do to contain communism around the world. And containment simply means, for our discussion, stopping the spread of something. I liken it in class to, you know, you going home from school and you're trying to get a little drink and you pour some red Kool-Aid in a cup and then you set it down on the bar while you're getting a snack, and then you turn around like sometimes happens and you hit the cup and it starts to spill. And the liquid in that cup might run over to over the bar and onto, let's say, white carpet. That would be bad because you would have red Kool-Aid spilling and spreading on white carpet. You know, think about it. A lot of people saw communists as reds, and nobody wanted to see communism spread around the world or at home in America. So the Red Scare, the second Red Scare, develops out of this, and the containment policy to contain communism wherever it's setting itself up is going to be something that people are going to do. Around this time, you have the National Security Act being passed. It creates the CIA. It basically helps to create the modern intelligence arm of the United States today. All right, and all these things were kind of designed to look out for communism, again, at home and abroad, not just abroad. In 1947, Mr. Truman announces the Truman Doctrine. And the Truman Doctrine is going to be related to containment because it's going to say that the United States will do whatever it needs to do to defend against communism in the world, to contain it. At this time, Greece and Turkey, two former countries that were aided by Britain for years, were having issues in their countries with different groups that were fighting. Traditionally, Britain helped those two countries, but they were out of money. In 1947, the British will lose the jewel of their crown, which was India, you know, as a colony. So Britain comes to the United States and basically lays it out that, hey, they cannot help Greece and Turkey anymore. What does Mr. Truman do? He issues the Truman Doctrine, and he will provide aid for Greece and Turkey. Remember, if you see Truman Doctrine on a test, it will very much relate to containment. Another thing that the United States will do in that same year, 1947-48, it will issue the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan is going to provide aid to war-torn European countries during World War II, and there were two really good reasons for the Marshall Plan, named after Secretary of State George C. Marshall, who had been basically a single-minded and very much a organizer of American forces during World War II. He had been Franklin Roosevelt's chief of staff. But, you know, Europe was destroyed by war. And so there were two reasons for having the Marshall Plan. One was definitely the humanitarian reason, because Europe needed to be rebuilt. It had just been, you know, devastated by bombing and war and fire and so forth. And so a good example of the goal of the Marshall Plan was to give little children, little girls, shoes, to send tractors over so French farmers could put in a crop. And the first thing is humanitarian. However, the second thing could be related to communism. If you send goods to a European country, you know, they may be less inclined to turn towards communism. So the Marshall Plan was a great success as Europe recovered, okay? Think about how wonderful the United States was. At this time, we even extended Marshall Plan aid to a perceived enemy, the Soviet Union. Of course, the Soviet Union said no to that kind of aid because it didn't fit in line with communist ideology. Well, one of the first big tests in Europe in the Cold War was something called the Berlin Airlift. And in 1948, the Soviets closed all the entrances and exits to the Allied zones in the city of Berlin. And basically they're trying to, you know, provoke some kind of conflict. There was a British idea to fly in all the supplies that were needed for the West Berlin people, to fly it in by air, instead of trying to send the military in and accelerating or acerbating a conflict. Hay Truman signed on to this plan, and for about 13 months, the Allies, particularly Great Britain and France, will fly in all the materials that the civilians in Berlin, West Berlin, will need. This included milk, sugar, medicine, coal, tons and tons of these kinds of things. The weekend that experienced the largest tonnage of shipment into West Berlin was Easter weekend, 1949. You know, pretty soon the Soviets realized that, hey, this, we can't keep this up. You know, clearly what we wanted here was not what we got, and so they will back off. This was a great way, a clever way of proving that a war or a conflict can be won somewhat peacefully, and especially cleverly. And frankly, it just made the Soviet-Russian people or military and government look like a bunch of schmucks, because what they wanted to get out of it, they did not. But this is one of the first big, what I call, push-pull events in the Cold War in Europe. Like I said, in 1947, the National Security Act will be passed. It created the Department of Defense. It created the CIA and the National Security Administration in America, that intelligence arm of the United States. Also in 1949, the Western Alliance, the Western Allies, created something called NATO. And NATO, very important to know, was the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Remember NATO. The former commander of D-Day, Dwight David Eisenhower, became its first supreme commander. And this becomes very important for the Western world to guard against Soviet expansion anywhere in the world. And also in 1949, the Soviets will test the atomic bomb. And so now, with the Soviets having the atomic bomb, the United States is moving on to trying to develop a hydrogen bomb, which is like the atomic bomb on steroids. So, you know, these are just some things that are occurring during this time as America sets up its containment apparatus. Well, a big blow to Harry Truman occurred in 1949, and that was when Mao Zedong and the Communist Party in China will finally be successful in defeating the Kuomintang, the nationalists in China, and mainland China will go to a communist-controlled government. The nationalists, the Kuomintang forces, will retreat to Taiwan, or what it was called, Formosa at the time. And that will that'll provide for interesting relations, because the United States at the time will not recognize the communist government of China, and will recognize that the nationalist government of China is the government of China that America wants to deal with, but they're in Taiwan. Harry Truman will be accused by Republicans of losing China, and that will be a big political blow to the president in his second term. Harry Truman was not expected by a lot of people to win the election of 1948. However, he campaigns very well, uses polling very well, and, you know, even though he goes to bed the night of the election in November of 1948, and he thinks it's his last official night as president in the White House, he's going to, you know, in his mind, he's going to wake up in the morning as a lame duck president. But overnight, the farm vote comes in, particularly from his home state of Missouri, and Harry Truman has won. But by 1949, losing China was a big blow to his presidency. The following year, you begin the Korean War. North Korea, aided by Russia and Communist China, will attack South Korea. And that in the summer of 1950, this begins a three-year war, basically, that will claim the lives of 53,000 Americans being killed and wounded as part of United Nations forces. So in the summer of 1950, Northern Communists will invade the South. The United States goes before the United Nations, a new body that had been chartered in October of 1945, and makes the case that United Nations forces need to stop this aggression in Korea. And Douglas MacArthur will be put in charge of all United Nations forces. In late summer, early fall 1950, there'll be a breakout of a small perimeter being held by South Koreans called the Pusan Perimeter. And then in September of 1950, there is a strategic landing that Douglas MacArthur organizes at Incheon, which divides the North Korean army. MacArthur will later send his army to Seoul, the capital of South Korea, and as the battle for Seoul is going on, the southern president, Syngman Rhee, will be reinstated as the president of South Korea. And then, of course, MacArthur and the 8th Army, led by Walton Walker, will drive heartily towards the north and into the north. They will end up around Thanksgiving at the Yalu River. They have not crossed over into China, you know, and this brings up a point. Harry Truman doesn't want a wider war with China. The commander of United Nations forces, Douglas MacArthur, would rather fight China at that time. He claimed to know the Asian man better than anybody living in the United States and knew what needed to happen. So here you have a geopolitical and a political difference between the President of the United States and the leading general at the time. You're going to see that Chinese troops will end up crossing the Yalu River around Thanksgiving of 1950. MacArthur, who had told the president that the Chinese would not cross the border, has to kind of duck and cover and cover his steps. He will write letters to his Republican friends in Congress criticizing the president's handling of the war, and Truman will eventually, in April of 1950, fire the general. General MacArthur comes home to a large ticker tape parade. In fact, at the time, it set the record for the largest ticker tape parade in American history. He will give a speech before Congress where he gives those very famous lines, "Old soldiers never die, they just fade away." And he did fade away, because as the Army hearings come out, it showed that MacArthur had, you know, given some false information and had read the situation a bit wrong, in Korea at the time. Although MacArthur's statement was correct if you're in a war, in a conflict, and he said there is no substitute for victory. What Truman wanted to do was fight a limited war, not to antagonize China. And MacArthur preferred to fight China if China invaded. And this was going to be a big deal. But between April of 1950 and 1953, the war is largely a stalemate, with some very heroic battles fought in a lot of places, but most notably Pork Chop Hill. The war basically ends where it begins, along the 38th parallel. You know, there were a lot of fears of communists, not only abroad, but also at home. People were creating their own bomb shelters. You could open up the Sears and Roebuck catalog and purchase your kit to build a bomb shelter. People were living with the fear of atomic war, nuclear war. You're going to see that the 1950s also is a great age of science fiction. But people are very fearful of what would happen in case of a nuclear attack. They're also fearful of communists at home. The government established a special committee called the House Un-American Activities Committee. And they will attack people in the cultural areas of the United States, in literature and art, and in the movies. But basically anybody could be, you know, labeled and attacked as a communist. One of the cases early on is that 10 Hollywood actors and actresses are called up in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee. They refuse to testify against their fellow actors and actresses. And this was a very big case because the House Un-American Activities Committee is absolutely what it was, a committee trying to look for un-American things. If you were in Hollywood, you could be blacklisted from a job, whether you are a director or a screenwriter or an actor or actress. Blacklisting was a really big fear. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in class. A good example about how fearful people were is the Rosenberg case in about 1950. The Rosenbergs were a couple. Today they are the only couple in American history executed for spying in America. We'll see a little interview in class from the two Rosenberg children. You had the Alger Hiss case. He was a State Department official accused of spying. And basically he called out the use of the pumpkin papers. Apparently, Alger Hiss would, you know, take papers and store them in a hollowed-out pumpkin, and then they would be picked up by a Soviet spy. So Alger Hiss, the Alger Hiss case, the Rosenberg case, are examples of this fear of communism during this particular time. Joseph McCarthy, senator from Wisconsin, very famous for his witch hunts about people in America who were communist, a very young, a couple of attorneys like Richard Nixon and Robert Kennedy will be working, Nixon with the House Un-American Activities Committee, and of course Robert Kennedy, a very young Robert Kennedy, on Joseph McCarthy's staff. So a lot of wheeling and dealing at home in America regarding communists. Remember containment, remember the Truman Doctrine. Remember the Communist Revolution making Communist China. Remember Korean War beginning and the United Nations standing in to try to contain communism. The war ends where it begins. Remember the House Un-American Activities Committee. All right, exactly just what it is during the second Red Scare. Remember the Rosenbergs. They tend to show up on your final exam because only couple in American history executed for spying. Well, you know, what are some other things happening in the 1950s besides communism? In 1944, the U.S. Congress passed the GI Bill. Another name for it was the Servicemen's Readjustment Act. In about 1947-48, a GI, or anybody for that matter, could buy a brand new home in America, ranch style, for less than $8,000. So the GI Bill is going to provide a low-cost loan for servicemen and women to go to college, to start a business, to buy a home, and that's a big deal. A good example of how the government used the GI Bill was the building of suburbs, and one of the most famous suburbs was Levittown, along Long Island, New York, and Levittown was a suburb, and now people can live in a suburb and drive to work and not necessarily have to live in the city. So, you know, suburbs were not new, but because of government grants and government help, a lot of new suburbs developed. It'll be in this time period of the 1950s and 60s that the first suburban mall, the indoor suburban mall, was developed. And why was this developed? It was developed to serve people in the suburbs. You have the new automobiles, you know, really coming of age in the late 40s, early 50s, as American companies, which were used to building tanks and planes and jeeps, were now retooling back from guns, going back to butter, and building cars. And so the car culture of the 1950s greatly accented the building of suburbs and things like suburban malls. Also, you had the baby boom, and the baby boom begins in 1945, 46, but it doesn't peak until 1957. It lasts until 1964. The baby boom is going to add 25 million children to the American population. And so you needed places to live, and you needed schools, and you needed all these services for families living in the suburb. As I was talking to my neighbor recently, he talked about not only the times, but also the culture. You generally, mama stayed home. Dad went to work. This is generally, you know, there are always exceptions, but you know, dad drove to work. Dad came home at 5 o'clock, and you ate supper, and then you sat out on the porch. And you know, your neighborhood was important, and you knew who your neighbors were. As television gets developed more, people tend to, you know, go inside a little more. Not. You know, it didn't change overnight, but people go inside a little more and start scheduling their time a little bit more around television. And, you know, an average family in the 1950s might have a television at the beginning of the decade of the 1950s. A good many families at the end of the 1950s will have two televisions in their home. But remember the GI Bill and the baby boom, because you're either going to have one or both of those on your final exam. You know, Truman was a good leader. A lot of people did not think that he was going to be a good president because he had never gone to college. He had been a failed businessman. He had been a senator who had looked at controlling wasteful spending during World War II. And then by 1944, Franklin Roosevelt did not like the vice president that was on the ticket at the time. And so he removed him, the party removed him, and replaced Truman on the ticket. Truman and Roosevelt did not have a great relationship, but Truman honored Roosevelt by, you know, accepting the unconditional surrender of Japan at the end of World War II. Truman had a phrase, the buck stops here. And post-war economy was a big, major concern for him. And so one of the things that he was going to do was to work out a better plan for labor unions. And in 1947, Truman will sign the Taft-Hartley Act. And the Taft-Hartley Act basically began the open shop in America. In other words, it ended the closed shop. You did not have to join the union to get the job. You could decide whether or not in many industries about whether you wanted to join a union or not. Truman was big on civil rights, and one of the things he does during his first term is he sends the Freedom Train around the United States. The Freedom Train was a train which carried a lot of America's documents, the Constitution, the Declaration, the Gettysburg Address, and, you know, I love this. One of the things that this train would do is it would stop in major cities, and you could walk on and you could look at the documents that make America great. And but one of the things Truman requested was that there would only be one entrance to the Freedom Train. There wouldn't be the usual separate entrances for white and for black people. So he's big on civil rights. One of the things that he does in 1947 is he signs an executive order that will integrate the American Armed Forces. There will be no longer be segregation in the American Armed Forces. The 1948 election was critical because as a result of his civil rights stand, 8 southern states will break off from the Democratic Party and they will attempt to run their own segregationist candidate, and his name was Strom Thurmond. You know, they're not successful, but you know, 8 southern states are making their stand on keeping things the way they are racially in America. Of course, Truman will, you know, defeat the Republican candidate, Thomas Dewey, along with Strom Thurmond, and win that election of 1948. And I'll show you a pretty cool picture of it in class. Truman wanted to continue some of the measures of the New Deal, but he simply repackaged some of them and called them the Fair Deal. Congress supported some of these measures. Some of them they did not. So just remember that Truman's Fair Deal was not as successful as Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. When Truman leaves office in 1952, or to be more exact, at the inauguration of Dwight David Eisenhower in early 1953, he transfers power to one of the greatest men in American military history. It was a hope that, you know, that the 1950s would continue on a good pace, economically, socially, politically, so forth. And we're going to find that good pace is transfixed by things like a civil rights movement, by conflicts in the Middle East, by more conflicts with Soviet Russia. And we're going to find that Dwight David Eisenhower, the oldest president at the time to take office, is going to be seen as a grandfatherly figure in America. And we're going to see some things that happen there that are good and some things that perhaps aren't so good. And then by the 1960 election, we'll witness the oldest elected president in America at the time transfer the presidency to the youngest elected president at the time in 1960-61, and that, of course, is John F. Kennedy. So that's a good place to stop for us, but remember the presidency of Harry Truman, and review this lecture as needed.